Hello, and welcome to the Well Collab Feminine Leadership Podcast. I am Tammy Zadunik, founder of the Well Collab, and your host for today. Our podcast features feminine leadership principles and women leading both in their professional and personal lives. Let's get started.
I'm excited to get more into this. When we stopped having the Well membership and we turned it into a movement, I just feel like my plate has really lifted. Like a lot of stuff in my plate has just lifted off of me. And I feel like my freedom is back, which I was really lacking. Right.
Yeah. I'm so glad to hear that.
You know, it feels like much better. I'm just like, it's so fun because we don't really know each other. So it always feels
I know. I'm excited too.
It always feels like a getting to know each other sort of a thing, which is really great. Heather, if you want to share a little bit about yourself.
Yeah. So I'm a nature-based clinical counselor in Whistler, British Columbia, and I have a practice in this, what we call the Sea to Sky corridor here between Vancouver and Pemberton, offering walk and talk therapy and serving clients with nature through a nature-based modality, which I've been very, very grateful for. It's a real privilege to work, not just in the context of nature, but in collaboration with, in relationship with nature, engaging in healing practices. And there's a lot of growing interest in this field. And there have been a lot of, there's been a real increase to the number of folks interested in and offering walk and talk therapy, especially since COVID, when meeting in an office became at some points unsafe. So that's one thing that I do. That's sort of my day job. And then outside of that, and accidentally, I've launched this book series called Awfully Hilarious, which is part of now a growing movement to help destigmatize mental health through stigma smashing true stories and talking about taboos. So Tammy, I'm really excited today to just talk with you openly about all the things we've been told not to talk about.
Yeah. This is so interesting that you connected with me and the Well, because I feel like my whole healing journey with my mental illness or my mental health and wellness has been through telling people what I'm going through, and often in the moment, like instead of sort of hiding and being ashamed, because I have panic attacks and I've had dealt with agoraphobia and quite severely. And I remember like being on a bus in my 20s and starting to have a panic attack and just turning to the woman behind me and telling her what was going on. And she said, "Oh, I have those. I take a medication for that." So this is like 25 years ago. And she said, "Yeah, I take a medication for that and it's okay." And I was like, you know, when you're, for people listening who have panic, it immediately dissipated the panic. It just left my body and I felt so heard and seen and safe. And I feel like I just used that and would always tell everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And over 25 years ago, people weren't really talking about it.
Right. And of course, listeners probably can't see that I'm just nodding along with you. But Tammy, there's such courage there. And I'm curious to dive into that a bit more about what enabled you to turn to a perfect stranger and share. And then if only she were in the room, too, how she was able to respond, what that was like for her. But I'm loving this and not remotely surprised that validation and support in that moment, with what we know now about the nervous system and co-regulating with other people, that was actually the solution to make it go away in the moment. That's so beautiful. But I'm really seeing the courage to connect. And I'm curious how you're able to do that.
It's interesting. Like, I guess it could be seen as courageous. I suppose it is, especially for people who are uncomfortable to share. But for me, it was more of a desperate act. It was what I had to do in the moment to survive. That it felt, panic has always felt like life or death for me. Mm-hmm. So I have, to me, it felt like the road of least resistance, to be honest. And I am a very spiritual person, and I just believe that she was the one who was supposed to be there to rescue me in that moment. And I think it's hard, but being able to trust that there are people to rescue us and that strangers are good, that people, there will be people put in your path to help you. I feel like that, I just already had that attitude and I trusted people were good. So I think probably some of that is from my upbringing, that I was from a small town and I wasn't really afraid of talking to strangers. Do you know that Malcolm Gladwell book, Talking to Strangers?
Yes.
One of my favorite books. I really feel like I trusted that people were good. So I think I had a lot of things going for me that a lot of people wouldn't necessarily have going for them. I would love to talk to her. That's so funny that you said that. I thought, I don't even know what she looks like. Like, I can't remember. But she made me feel so good. I also didn't want to take meds. So it also was interesting in that way, too. I was like, oh, that was the first I'd heard anyone kind of say, oh, you're having a panic attack. And I take meds for that.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's almost, it just makes me wonder, you know, perhaps there are angels everywhere. And also, but as putting that in context, 20 years ago, early 2000s, people were not openly talking about mental health and panic, and certainly not medication to support with mental health. So that's really, it's quite groundbreaking. And I appreciate you sharing that, because the big piece of the concept with Awfully Hilarious and a lot of clinical counseling work in general is the idea of supporting people through those moments where they feel very alone, that linking arms increases our resilience and in some cases makes something awful ultimately hilarious or at least bearable.
Yeah, at least bearable. That's really good. And I love how you talk a lot about menstruation and our periods. That's something that I love talking about. And I think definitely that when I listened to a different podcast you were on, and I was like, wow, this Heather really resonates for me. Like, I feel like we do different things, but we're very aligned in the way we think. And I really think that those moments I've had where I've been able to trust strangers has been what's enabled me to open the well and bring together people who don't know each other and have these really deep, deep connection and conversations with strangers.
Well, and I really love your story to open us up there, because I've taken the very opposite approach. As a little kid, I was very shy. I present as an extrovert, but I'm still quite a shy person, even though I do a lot of public speaking these days. And for me, when I've run into trouble, my default mode was to swallow it, to get smaller, to hold it in. And that was so harmful to me that it's part of what's really kind of gently forced me towards this Awfully Hilarious project. And ultimately, we'll get into this a bit more if you'd like, but I have a condition called premenstrual dysphoric disorder that I didn't know about for 30 years. So I was misdiagnosed with all sorts of different things, all sorts of different mood disorders, when really it's something totally related to my menstrual cycle. But because I never really connected with or spoke about my menstrual cycle, and the world didn't either, it's so deeply stigmatized, it took over 3 decades to diagnosis, and this despite me being the daughter of a doctor. So now you can't get me to shut up about premenstrual dysphoric disorder, and it's not comfortable for me. I didn't want to talk about menstruation and periods, but I feel that I have to, because at risk of more people going undiagnosed for a long time, I really feel that I now have a story to tell and feel compelled to tell it, if only to decrease diagnosis time for somebody out there. On average, it's roughly about 10 years, like about 9 years to diagnosis, which is far too long. It's a potentially very dangerous, life-threatening condition for folks, and many, many, many people with it and their families who are in the swirl with them don't know about it. And again, I love what you're doing with the well, because this comes down to which sort of bodies we've studied, what type of research we've funded, ultimately who matters. And for a long time, that was not female-bodied folks. So
yeah,
and I'm a privileged white female-bodied person, cis, straight, daughter of a doctor, and it took 3 decades to diagnose it. So I would really love to use the position I'm in to speak loudly about this, such that others might find the information that's been not only not available, but deliberately suppressed for a long time.
Let's tell people. I love that we're merging our audiences and we're able to use this get this information to our audience and the women who are following us. So can you tell me what it is?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll speak from my perspective as somebody personally who's navigated this, and as in my role as a clinical counselor. Outside of that, though, physicians, it's a physiological condition, but the symptoms very often show up as psychological. So a lot of people end up in therapy treatment, which I was for 30 years, but it's a physiological thing that happens. So 1 in 20 menstruating folks, and this is kind of what we know now, the research is unfolding day by day. So what I'm saying now might be disproven tomorrow or changed tomorrow. But what we think we know is that 1 in 20 menstruating folks have a really very intense response to any shift in hormones. So their hormone levels might be normal, but the regular shift that would happen for most menstruating bodies at ovulation, that shift is felt very dramatically in 1 in 20 people. And when progesterone rises, for most folks, it'll feel generally very relaxing. Whereas the 1 in 20 have more, almost, it looks more like an allergic reaction where the wheels fall off, anxiety spikes, depression spikes, total overwhelm. And then the trigger warning here is that also 1 in 3 people suffering from premenstrual dysphoric disorder has experienced suicidal ideation. They think it's actually as high as about 36%, which is what makes this, one of the things that makes this very dangerous. And then as far as diagnosing it, the way to do that is just to track the cycle for 2 months, and symptoms have to be completely relieved and alleviated upon bleeding. So with menstruation, a day or two into menstruation, the symptoms go away.
Yeah.
And this cycle.
Because of your estrogen levels, because of how the estrogen plays into the body. I've only done a little bit of learning on that with doing some of the longer fasts with some female doctors, the kind of leading me to do that, showing me that you do that on like day 1 and 2 when you start to bleed, because to do with your estrogen levels, your hormone levels. But that's so interesting. So my mind is going, well, how does that play into babies and menopause?
Mm-hmm. Well, what's so interesting is that, and I'm going to say this in air quotes, the cure for premenstrual dysphoric disorder is menopause or pregnancy. The symptoms aren't felt during pregnancy for most part, nor during menopause. So for people who have really having an extreme experience of this, one of the solutions is to induce chemical menopause. There are a number of different treatments. That's sort of one of the ones further down the line. But those are really good questions about what happens with babies with menopause. Sometimes people might, premenstrual dysphoric disorder might show up after the birth of one of their children, for example. Other people, in my case, the onset was with my first period immediately. My mom said it was as though a switch flipped. I got my first period a couple of weeks later, immediately developed really serious eating disorder, which is also highly comorbid with premenstrual dysphoric disorder. Another reason I want to talk about this, because we're talking about some of the most fatal diagnoses in the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. And there's such lacking advocacy, research, attention to this area for a lot of reasons, but really specifically because it's tied to the menstrual cycle.
Yeah. Yeah. There was this artist, and I'm going to try to find the image to share when we post this, but it was years ago now, probably 10 years ago. And I will credit her. I just don't have her at top of mind right now. She did this photo on Instagram, and she was all in white and her legs were spread and she was sitting on the floor and the whole room was white and she was bleeding. Did you see it?
Oh, I've got goosebumps. I can't remember her name, but yeah, I was very moved by that image.
We will make sure I'll find her and credit her. I follow her still. But first, I think it starts with a P. For some reason, I just can't grab it. I was so moved. That was the first time I saw anyone publicly post that. And I have seen it now. I think with the influx of, we've always had female directors, but more female directors being highlighted in movies and television. And I've been seeing periods shown and blood shown so much more on TV. Well, not so much on TV, but in movies. And I'm just so grateful for it. I know I raised 2 boys, I have 2 teenagers, and they really know a lot. And we talk very openly about it here at home. And I just find it fascinating. I mean, we female bodies bleed and we don't die. We bleed every month and we don't die. Fascinating. I just find that so fascinating in itself. It's so miraculous and amazing. I love my period. My daughter and I, we had a celebration when she got hers. I had my girlfriends come over and some of my mom and her bubba and share stories about when they got their period and how that looked for them. And they brought her little gifts and they like read her little poems. And when I get it, I just say to her, we both love when we get it. And we just say, oh, it feels so good to just bleed. Doesn't it feel so good just to cleanse it out and get it out? I mean, I know it doesn't feel good for everyone, but I'm trying to attach positive, at least in our home, to it.
Oh, Terry, yeah, that's beautiful. That's really beautiful. And it's interesting when I think back to my case. I'm the eldest of 3 daughters, and my mom was wonderful with me when I got my first period. I thought I was dying, actually. I looked in the toilet and saw blood, and that's indicates something's wrong, right? That hadn't happened before in my young life. And so I wanted to scream for my parents and think, you know, something very serious is wrong. And my mom was an incredible support, as was my dad. But my mom took me out for a special lunch and I felt celebrated. And And this was also, I'm 45 now, this was also happening within a culture where, you know, you hid the tampon up your sleeve, you kept it a secret. And so despite my family's best efforts, I still really swallowed the message that this is shameful, it's secret, it's, you've got to hide it away. My approach was sort of like, ignore, push through, just pretend it's not happening, which again, that's the flawed approach I took to a lot in life. And I think it's really interesting that somehow you didn't. Somehow when things got really hard for you or when things arose, you were able to speak to someone. And in the case of the panic attack, a stranger who offered you something you needed. And I even think about in my role as a clinical counselor, people are paying to come meet for maybe an hour and talk about things. And it's such potent work. And ultimately, how beautiful would it be to decolonize this work such that we have spaces and community, safe spaces and community, where we can really open up about what's going on and not necessarily have to find ourselves in private spaces to speak about these things and not even let somebody know that we have a counselor. Counseling really has its place, absolutely. And I think we could do a lot better job holding one another as sisters, partners, families. And I mean, in I'm using that language in sort of more universal ways, just being together in community, like a larger, I love the idea of the larger red tent.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the red tent. That's how I think about the well. We're the womb. We're kind of, like, but I want, you know, what I want, and if I'm going to put it out there and manifest it, is I want the powers that be, I want the government to recognize that community is often the solution to a lot of mental health. And and I want to hear your take on it, because I'm not a mental health practitioner. So please, if I'm wrong, please like call me out, tell me. I feel like from my experience, bringing women together in the circles is very healing and cathartic. And I don't want there to be the limiting factor, because we charge for it so that my time is honored and the rental and all these things are paid for. But wouldn't it be amazing if that was something that the government really valued and would pay for, but they sort of always want to pay for things that then have an RO, is it RTO, investment return, that you can calculate in a number. So maybe eventually there would be less numbers going seeking mental health or something, or in the hospitals, but that the amount of time that would take, it's not something you could really measure. And I find that really hard. I really wish that, like, I'm a privileged woman who has a lot of community and who also has had enough experiences with community to know how to build it just from my life. And I'm able to build it on my street. I'm able to build it so I'm able to care for myself and my family that way. But a lot of people don't have that experience, and we're so individual. And I just feel like, wow, how can the government come alongside us and value community?
Which I love. And I often think, like, I would absolutely love, something's happening on my computer. I'm right on board there too. Like, I would love to see more support of mental health. It's funny that we separate sort of the brain off from the body. And in any case, I think though it's a much bigger challenge than that. I'm with you. Yes, more community spaces. And in some ways, well, in many ways, I feel very, very privileged to be in Canada and find the way that our universal healthcare system does provide a lot of support. We have amazing supports through CMHA, Canadian Mental Health Association, lots of incredible opportunities for group therapy, et cetera. And we need more. And I think the problem is bigger. From my perspective, it's really that we're operating under a false narrative. We're living in this hyper-individualistic capitalist society that is more about individualized and competitive, as opposed to a space where we might have more collective spaces to grow, to heal, to learn. So I think it's actually a massive societal issue. And it would be really interesting actually to look at stats in more collectivist cultures and see what the mental health statistics look like there.
Yeah, I love a lot of my friends that have either are refugees to Canada or have immigrated here. And when they talk about how weird it is to them that we don't live with our parents, mm-hmm. or our elders, and even talking about in the refugee camps, how as horrific as that is, there's this beautiful piece of this one. My friend shared a story with me about crying in the night. Someone had lost their child, or their child was really sick and they were crying. And in all the tents in the camp, a collective crying started happening.
Oh,
And the whole, like, all the tents could hear each other because you don't have the soundproofing like we do in our homes. No one knows if I'm sad in my house. I can hide. And my neighbors don't know. And they don't know if I'm not healthy or if I'm not parenting healthy. There's the accountability just is kind of missing. And when I think about that refugee camp, I think of it like, wow, what a beautiful community support to have that collective empathy. And I think, sure, you don't want to be in the refugee camp. You know, Euphra, she wanted to come here. I know her here now, but we're missing that here. Like, there's so many
100%
in the struggle.
Like, Tammy, that really brought tears to my eyes, actually, as you're sharing that experience of, like, people going through deeply traumatic experience and also the supportive community, the resilience amongst people, that the connection between us is what helps us survive absolutely unbearable circumstance. And I couldn't be more delighted to be having this conversation today, talking about breaking down barriers and boundaries between one another, even as we're living in a world where borders are being fortified as we speak, women's rights are being taken away as we speak, immigrant rights are being taken away as we speak. I feel so I just feel that these conversations are so necessary that we need to link arms so badly.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think that can carry us a long way. It reminds me, it's so interesting. Was it Mr. Rogers' mom who said, when the world's on fire, look to who's fighting the fire, look to the heroes. And this is something I do a lot in my clinical practice also, is find the resilience, find the strength. We don't ignore the pain point, but we don't necessarily poke around at the pain point. We want to find where the resilience is and feed the resilience. And I'm trained in I'm trained through a Buddhist inspired school. I went to Naropa University to do my wilderness therapy degree. And I don't identify as Buddhist, but so many of the teachings really spoke to me. And one of them is sort of, if there are two wolves at the door and you want to steer your life in a particular direction, which is the wolf that's going to win in a fight between the wolves? Well, it's the wolf that you feed. And so what do you attend to? What do you feed? I'm telling that story poorly, but the idea about what we attend to is what we can grow. So that story of the refugee camps, the resilience of the coming together and sharing, even sharing in grief, if at all possible, lessen the burden just 1 ounce for your neighbor.
Yeah. Yeah,
what happens to us when we do that for someone else too? It's inherently helpful to the giver as well as the receiver.
Oh, hey, now I'm thinking, I love that we're just taking this conversation where it goes. I'm sure you haven't seen this movie because I feel like you're not a horror movie watching kind of guy.
No, I'm not.
nor am I, but my son is, and he's 17, and I trust him to watch movies with him that are scary because he makes it okay for me.
Oh,
it's a wonderful, beautiful soul. He's so kind, and he's also so dramatic. He's like his mom. We watched Heretic on the weekend, or was it Monday night? And at the end of the movie, so the whole premise of the movie, so spoiler alert, if you haven't seen Heretic, if you're not going to see it, let's keep listening. You probably most of our listeners won't see it. Is this guy wants to kind of disprove faith. Like he's sort of brought in these two women from the Church of Latter-day Saints, and they've knocked on his door and he's brought them in, and he's sort of tormenting and torturing them all night, basically. But at the end of the movie, so his whole thing is, do you believe or do you disbelieve? And he makes them choose a door. And a disbelieve would really go against everything they've been told and everything they've said. But belief, like, they're not really 100% on board with that either, because they're kind of just doing what they've been taught. And they pick the door, they go downstairs. At the end of the movie, everyone's like dying, basically. And the man who has been trying to disprove faith goes and lays with the girl, the missionary, as she's praying. And she said, I don't really believe prayer works, but I believe that there's something special happens when I pray for you. So I am praying for you, and you are hearing me pray for you. And I think that's special. It actually doesn't matter if prayer works or not. And I thought, that's just so fascinating, because it's the spiritual connection of when we do something for, like, the energy I'm feeling from you right now that we're sharing, not even being in the same, like being across Zoom. And there's this spiritual connection. and these things that happen and come up, and it doesn't actually really matter if it works or not. I just found like that was so fascinating. And I think that's kind of what you're talking about. I don't even know what reminded me of that, but you were talking about maybe that, like that spiritual, that connection between people and how it makes such a difference in people's lives. And it, even in that, I think, wow, like that's so true. It just doesn't even matter if it's what you believe.
It's well, and it's so potent what you're saying, because what is working? So in the case of turning in your midst of your panic attack to the woman behind you, something worked. Right. And so, but what is that? And can you reproduce it? And I find it really interesting. I love Einstein's piece around not all that matters can be measured and not all that can be measured matters. But we also, what are we measuring? What is mattering? And in this interesting realm of, you know, I'm trained in what's called transpersonal psychology, but in this realm of the human spirit, there's a lot that we know to be true that we don't measure. It's really interesting. Nature-based therapy, there's actually quite a solid body of evidence and research, but that's helpful, and that will help with funding, et cetera, et cetera. And also, we already know. We are of the earth, and we know that it is good to be with the forest. Mm. We know that something happens when we turn to the sun. We already know this, and yes, we're measuring it, and yes, that does matter for a lot of reasons. I worked with the Pine River Institute, which was a residential addiction treatment center in Ontario that's fantastic, and the way they've been able to not only really support people with excellent outcomes and increase the number of beds is because they've done solid research and they continue to be funded. So
yes,
in that context, it really matters. And you could say to most people, I'm going to go for a walk in the woods, and we already know, oh, that's probably pretty good for us.
Right. We don't disagree. We don't argue about that. We know that. We don't always know the measurement of it, but I you're right. You know, you're right. It does matter. It matters that we can measure things, because it does continue to bring important research, and it brings money to where we need it. And it does matter. And sometimes I think it's figuring out, how do you measure it?
Well, and it's
untangible.
Yeah. And some of it can be measured. Some of it's really hard to measure. But for example, when I was becoming a clinical counselor, one of the things we talk about is how can you be really resilient and protect yourself against vicarious trauma, for example. And a few of the factors, there was really excellent research done around this. Some of the factors are really seeing the humanity in the people that you're working with. So getting actually closer than further away, the opposite, you know, people might think they have to really shield yourself, but it's seeing the humanity in who you're working with and their resilience. A big piece of it is your own spirituality. So your own sense of interconnectedness to a larger web, whatever that might be for you. And another huge piece is community. So who are you connected with? How wide is your web? How solid is the net that's holding you as you're holding others? And there are other pieces to it too, but they're, for the most part, the factors we're talking about today: community, spirituality, connection, resilience, and seeing the humanity in one another.
Mm. I love that.
So that's not only what helps us lead more meaningful lives, but also helps protect us against what would really break us down or stop us from being able to do the work we are all here to do.
Yeah. It's so beautiful. I know. I get so many amazing feelings, and there's such a huge payoff for me doing the work I do. There really is. Like being able to meet with you and hear you. You're such an expert in what you're talking about, and I know how much value there is for the people listening, so I'm really grateful for that. Thank you for being here. We're not ending. I just want to stop and say that.
Thanks, Tammy. I'm so glad. I feel really, the minute I heard about your community, I knew I wanted to be involved, and I love the visual and the idea and the language around a well, like being well, but also a deep well. And something we talk a lot about, of course, in my field is you want to pour from an overflowing cup. You don't want to pour out of your cup and leave your cup empty. So how might we continue to operate from a really full, well, a deep, sustainable space?
I was like, I need to bring us back to the menstruation piece. So this is perfect, because I think a lot of us feel when we're menstruating that our capacity is very limited, and we don't feel like we have a very full cup. And maybe that's different for everyone, but I think, how do our cycles through the month, like, can you speak to what you know or what you're passionate about menstruation, or like the cycles, mm-hmm. and how do we take care of ourselves in that?
Oh yeah, I'd love to. And I want to begin this by saying I am not an expert on the menstrual cycle. I spent most of my life ignoring it. I love Lucy Peach's work. She's called the Period Queen. She's written musicals about the cycle, and she has a beautiful way of describing it in a very humorous, playful way, describing the stages of the menstrual cycle and lining them up with the seasons. And she would suggest that we really harness our period power. And at the time of the month where you want to bake everyone a cake, you bake everyone a cake, and then you organize your life, if for those who can and have the privilege of doing so, for a few days where you retreat and rest and take care of yourself. I've become, unfortunately, not through choice, but this is what I get to do, is speak more from personal experience of what happens with an atypical cycle, or what happens with the cycle for those folks, the 1 in 20 for whom the wheels fall off. And because that's been my experience, as I now start to learn about the cycle, it becomes more a matter of survival and a matter of how to navigate with the capacity and resources that you have, and how to future-proof for yourself so that come the next really difficult season, you've got the supports in place to help carry you through. So part of it, this is a much longer story, but I actually believe PMDD to be an injury of a patriarchal society. I would be very curious to see what that would look like in matriarchal or other least structured societies. Mm-hmm. But in a patriarchal society, the design is that we're meant to, and in industrialized society, we're meant to work like machines, which means, you know, a certain number of hours a day, and then you put in fuel and then you keep going. But we're not machines. And a menstruating body doesn't work consistently in the same way day to day. So one of the harms is that, in particular with PMDD, trying to work consistently 40 hours a week, 5 days a week, through the month in the same way just doesn't work. In fact, there are those who would consider premenstrual dysphoric disorder to be what you'd call a dynamic disability, where on some days you have significantly more capacity than others, but you can't necessarily show up consistently in the same way. And as we start to learn this and work with this, we can have extraordinary access to creative resources and a really heightened sensitivity that can create beautiful, great art, and much more. But we ignore that to our detriment. And again, the patriarchal structure and industrialized system that says you work 40 hours a week, 5 days, or else, that's how what it looks like. If you're lucky in a developed country, that's all you work. So as far as the archetypal cycle of winter being the time we might bleed, and then we move into spring as the body begins to prepare for ovulation, ovulating at summer, and then moving back through the fall or the luteal phase. In general, for menstruating folks, the luteal phase is a time of more challenge, slowing down. That's where a lot of more of our self-critical thoughts start to pop up. Our appetite really increases often for carbs because, you know, there's a piece there where you're potentially preparing for baby if that has happened with ovulation. And then we come back to the winter and the bleed or a grieving period. And then with premenstrual dysphoric disorder, which is different from PMS, there's just an absolute intensity to that luteal cycle or that luteal phase. Where for many people, they might have a week or maybe two in a month to mend the relationships that might have been destroyed through that time, to get their job back if they exploded things during the luteal phase when they just didn't have the capacity or their neurotransmitters were out of whack. So it's interesting to ask me to speak to the menstrual cycle because I spent 30 years deliberately ignoring it. If that makes sense.
I think so many people who menstruate would relate to that, whether they have that or not, or whether it's a spectrum. And I mean, I don't know, and I don't want to say that people have it who don't, because that's also harmful for people who do have it. But I can definitely, I wonder if some women are diagnosed with bipolar who have.
Yeah. So I've been diagnosed with probably 7 things through my lifetime and mismedicated for many of them. Many people are misdiagnosed with other mood disorders. I was diagnosed with bipolar, atypical depression, anorexia. That truly was happening. But this is a common story, that there would be many, many diagnoses. And it looks, it can present like that, or like a cyclothymia where there are good days and then really bad days. And as you speak to it being a spectrum, most things in life, of course, are a spectrum. And there's really specific diagnostic criteria for premenstrual dysphoric disorder. It's very serious. And I think we've done a bit of a disservice to it over the years, suggesting that it is like PMS, because most menstruating people will experience some level of PMS. But with premenstrual dysphoric disorder, we're talking rage, potential suicidal ideation, like really life-altering type of symptoms, which, and then we can move through a spectrum towards a more mild PMS. You might experience cravings or a bit more weepiness or irritability, but at a different level. So I think you're right that most menstruating folks could probably relate to somewhat of an altered state, some different experience through different times of the month. But then certainly if you're listening and really identifying with, this really sounds like my sister or my daughter, or I can relate to a lot of this experience, then what I'd strongly suggest is checking out what's called the IAPMD.org. Maybe we can put it in the show notes. Thanks, Tammy. It's the International Association for Premenstrual Dysphoric Disorder, or Premenstrual Disorders, sorry. And they have a wealth of resources. They have information about where the practitioners are near you who might be able to support, because again, this is also new to the healthcare realm, so it can be hard to find a practitioner. There's a lot of advocacy work you may have to do for yourself. And most people, by the time they're diagnosed with PMDD, have been diagnosed with many other things.
Yeah, I'm really thinking of some friends who have been through down the bipolar road, and I'm wondering, and they really haven't felt like that was what it is. And I really think, yeah, this would be something for them to look into. I think this podcast is going to resonate for a lot of people, whether they are dealing with it themselves or they're saying, oh yeah, that's more serious. And I think someone I know has been talking about things like that, because I know that I do have friends who have this, but I don't think I recognized the intensity or what it is until now. So I really appreciate knowing. I just find like that must be so much harder in a trans person who is dealing with that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm so grateful that you brought that in. And I'm really speaking specifically to menstruating bodies, because you also think about the experience of a young person who doesn't identify as female, and then suddenly their period is coming. How absolutely awful that could be for somebody, or somebody assigned male at birth who doesn't identify as male, and their peers are all beginning to get their period. So puberty can be such an intense time for mental health challenges in general, and identity in general. But I'm really glad that you've brought me here, Tammy, and as you're speaking on this subject, I do hope that maybe somebody listening could share with a friend, because 1 in 20 menstruating folks with PMDD, that's high. We're talking about millions of people worldwide.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot of people. And yet it's, again, because menstruating bodies haven't been studied, this information has been overlooked, suppressed. We're just now starting to there's some very good work happening in the field now. And the IAPMD that I mentioned is really at the center as far as advocacy goes. It was started by a couple folks who have premenstrual dysphoric disorder, folks in their families with premenstrual dysphoric disorder, and they just came together as a very powerful organization to try and help where other help hadn't previously been available.
Yeah, which I do feel like so many female issues are advocated for in that way. Like there isn't, I was at the hospital for a stress test because I'm in my 40s and I'm in my perimenopause, and I just kind of was talking about my own issues, high blood pressure, like hypertension and cholesterol and these things, and she did just kind of poo-poo the perimenopause thing at the hospital. And I found that really interesting because I she was younger than me, and I just really felt like I feel like we're there. Like, I feel like we're there. Like, we're really hearing a lot about it. We're talking a lot about it. I think that we can talk about the hormones in a way that isn't just an excuse for being crazy, like for being labeled as crazy.
Yeah.
Like, it's just the hormones. No, the hormones are actually intensely powerful. And you think of what they've done in your body and in a lot of bodies and man. I would like.
And what's interesting is when you think about menstruating bodies, the hormonal cycle is actually very, for the most part, very predictable. Mm-hmm. Whereas in non-menstruating bodies, hormones might shift in response to a sports match. It can be really... So the idea that, you know, this volatility or the old language around someone being hysterical, et cetera, that's part of why PMDD was not diagnosed or added to the diagnostic statistical manual for so long. There was a concern that it might be a setback for the feminist movement, actually, that, and actually Shalene Gupta does a beautiful job in her book, The Cycle, about speaking to the history and why this has been so suppressed so long, and not always for evil intent, but the reasons behind it, which sort of, and it stacked towards the fact this was not added to the DSM until 2013, which is very late in the game. Something you were just saying there just really tweaked for me. I'll come back to it. Oh, when you're talking about, you know, people having to take into their own hands their healthcare. And I'm a huge fan of the universal healthcare system in Canada. I've always really been a big fan of Western medicine, and then now struggling with this challenge that has gone undiagnosed, unmet, really helps me to understand the vulnerability and how we might be drawn towards backroom cures when services aren't available to us. I mean, we can just have only to point to the abortion issue currently to really talk about that. In my first book, Awfully Hilarious, I've got a story I find hilarious now, but I found myself at basically a summer camp sort of a thing dealing with a yeast infection, and I didn't have access to Kinestin, or I didn't have access to a pharmacy, and somebody said, oh, try garlic, that always works for me. Fast forward, I end up in the emergency room having to have this garlic clove extracted. But that was one of those examples where I was shy, we didn't have access to the tools, and it happened in Victoria, British Columbia. So I walked in, they said, oh, honey, we see this every day. We'll get to that garlic clove in a second. But I ended up thinking, this is so ridiculous. I have to write it down because it's funny, but it also points to when we are not met, we sometimes have to take our health into our own hands. And, you know, what was I, 19? I had access to some yogurt and a garlic clove and not much information, and it went poorly. And I'm still here to tell the tale. Things could go much worse when we're talking about a more serious issue. But
things that have went up our vaginas.
Yeah.
That is a great place actually for us to just kind of wrap it up. Is I do want you to just plug your book a bit for us, because that sounds hilarious and I think we do need this book. So I would love for you just to talk a little bit about how the book happened and how, and then we'll kind of end with that, Heather. This has been so great.
Sure, we'll do. Well, the book happened. I actually went on a bad date. I went on a bad online date. I called my dear friend Paris in tears, and she said, oh, I've just come off of an awful date too. You know, we could write a book. And suddenly, you know, another friend of ours came together who's a beautiful designer. And she said, well, I've got some terrible date stories for you. You know, if only we just turned this into a zine and distributed it in little free libraries, and all those other folks having struggles online could know that they're not alone, and we'll call ourselves the Tinderellas, and we'll distribute this in little free bookshops everywhere and little libraries everywhere. And it ended up actually becoming a book full of stories about really disappointing online dates. And it started to include all the bodily functions that we might not talk about. And then it really took off, and it was so successful. We released it actually on Valentine's Day 2023 in order to support people who are feeling single, alone, disillusioned with dating, for all our Palentines and Galentines. And it really took off. And that when it did, I realized we're onto something here. Actually, we could use this format to start to destigmatize other conversations, to have other taboo topics. And the first one that came to mind, of course, was around periods, menstruation. So the first book is called Awfully Hilarious Stories We Never Tell. That's really the online dating and bodily function moments. And then the second one, Awfully Hilarious Period Pieces, speaks from first menses through to menopause and all the things in between, or if you want to menstruate and don't, all those different aspects. And we actually currently have a call for submissions out right now. If you're a writer or know writers in your community and want to talk about sex, sexuality, eros, desire, pleasure, We're looking for suppressed stories around sex, sexuality, eros, pleasure, desire. This one's going to be called Awfully Hilarious Pillow Talk. So I see you nodding. I'm hoping for a story from you, Tammy.
I am. I love sex. It's like my favorite thing to talk about. So 100% I will.
Let's talk about sex, baby.
I'm into that. So we'll have you back. So when is that book, do you think, will be out?
The call for submissions is open right now until April 15th. Yeah. And if we're lucky, I'm hoping to have it out before the end of the year in time for some kind of a sexy stocking stuffer.
Yeah. And then we'll have you back at the same time of year for Valentine's Day to talk about it. I think that would be great.
That would be wonderful. This is so fun. And I'm just so grateful for you and the Well and for all the folks listening and spreading the word to help one another out, linking arms.
Thank you for being a Well woman. And also, there are a bunch of women in Squamish that keep reaching out to me. So I think we're going to have to get a circle. They're going at some point.
Let's do it.